From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The previously undetectable designer steroid THG is now detectable, a development which many feel will blow the lid off what could be the most widespread athlete doping scandal in history. Ahead on Only a Game, the Balco investigation. Also an NBA season preview and a trip to Detroit to peruse possibilities for the Pistons. Also ahead on Only a Game, one last round of bunting banter with baseball guy Tim Kirkjian and an insider's look at the process governing the naming of thoroughbreds.
My father years ago had a horse called Onion. I mean, could you get a worse name than that? He ends up beating Secretariat up here in the Whitney, and then all of a sudden Onion didn't sound so bad. Yeah.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Hot, windy conditions are fueling several wildfires in Southern California that have forced hundreds of people from their homes. Eric Anderson of member station KPBS in San Diego has details.
A wildfire has destroyed four homes in Rancho Cucamonga near Los Angeles, and it's threatening hundreds of others. More than 11,000 acres have burned. In San Diego County, 300 homes in the DeLuz area are threatened by a 4,000-acre blaze. Firefighter Pat Boss says officials have made some progress containing the fire, but they're bracing for hot Santa Ana wind conditions.
Winds can create their own weather pattern. They're very erratic, and they'll do the same thing with the fire, make it very erratic, unpredictable, and totally unmanageable until it calms down, and then we go to that point in time and try to do something with it.
More than 1,400 firefighters are working to contain the blaze, which began on Camp Pendleton during some live fire ammunition training. For NPR News, I'm Eric Anderson in San Diego.
Organizers of an anti-war rally here in Washington, D.C. say they hope as many as 50,000 protesters will turn out for today's march. The rally is to begin at the Washington Monument and end with a march to the White House and the Justice Department. One organizer, Peter Lindsay, says the Bush administration has no right to try and recolonize Iraq. The protesters say U.S. troops should leave that country. The acting Secretary of the Army will visit Fort Stewart, Georgia this weekend. He'll be looking into complaints from some soldiers who say they receive poor care at the base when they're sick or injured. NPR's Adam Huckberg reports.
Acting Army Secretary Les Brownlee is planning to personally inspect Fort Stewart's Medical Hold Battalion. That's where soldiers are assigned when they're too sick or injured to be deployed. Over the past few days, several members of the National Guard and Reserve have come forward to complain about conditions in Medical Hold. They say they often have to wait weeks to see a doctor, and in the meantime, they say they're quartered in dirty, bug-infested barracks. The complaint sparked investigations both by the Army and by members of Congress. Now the Pentagon says Brownlee wants to check the conditions himself. Army leaders say they're working on ways to provide medical care more promptly, including having soldiers see private physicians rather than Army doctors. Also, they're thinking of permitting sick and injured reservists to get medical care in their hometowns rather than on base. Adam Huckberg, NPR News.
North Korea says it's taking a second look at President Bush's offer of a written security guarantee designed to resolve tensions over the North's nuclear ambitions. North Korea's foreign ministry spokesman said on state-run radio today his country is willing to consider the president's remarks if they're based on the intention to coexist with North Korea. Last week during the Asia-Pacific summit, Mr. Bush proposed a written assurance by the U.S. and four of Pyongyang's neighbors that they would not attack the North if it promises to scrap its nuclear program. You're listening to NPR News. The state of Utah has given up its effort to force chemotherapy on a 12-year-old boy against his parents' wishes. The case pitted parental rights against the responsibility of states to protect children. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
Juvenile court judge Robert Yates told the parents of 12-year-old Parker Jensen that if their son dies, they'll have no one to blame but themselves. That's according to participants in a closed hearing in the medical neglect case against the parents. Jensen was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, an aggressive and potentially fatal form of cancer. But his parents believe the removal of a small tumor left no cancerous cells in his body. Several oncologists recommended chemotherapy, saying undetectable cancer cells likely remained. The Jensen's refusal to permit treatment prompted kidnapping charges and a custody battle. Utah child welfare officials now say they can't force chemotherapy on an unwilling patient and his family. The case triggered parental rights protests at the state capitol and the intervention of the governor. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
In southern Russia, all 46 miners who were trapped in an underground coal mine for 2 days reportedly have been found alive. Rescuers did not know what they'd find since there was no contact with the miners. The miners became trapped when water from a nearby underground lake seeped into the shaft above them. The mine is located some 60 miles south of Moscow. A huge geomagnetic storm has reached the Earth's upper atmosphere. The storm is caused by an eruption of gas on the sun. Larry Combs, a space weather forecaster for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says a storm has interfered with airline communications. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The World Series, currently in progress, had been regarded as thoroughly unappreciated until fans got over the absence of the Red Sox and the Cubs and began watching the Marlins and Yankees on TV. The thoroughly televised phenomenon of pro football is, of course, in progress on college campuses across the land, as well as in the National Football League. And in case you have any more brain cells you can spare for big-time sports in a TV room near you, the National Basketball Association begins its games in earnest on Tuesday night, which is why I'm joined now by Scott Howard Cooper, who covers basketball for the Sacramento Bee. Scott, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's good to be with you again.
Scott, unfortunately, it is impossible to avoid the story of Kobe Bryant's felony sexual assault trial in Colorado, which will begin early next year. The personal toll on all involved will be high, especially on the alleged victim, no matter the outcome of the trial. What will the effect of the trial be on the Lakers and on the NBA?
Well, for the league as a whole, it's another black eye. And as for the Lakers, I think we're just beginning to see the impact, and it's going to carry on for quite a while. What we don't know for sure is how opposing fans are going to react to him. He hasn't really gotten out there too much. He's had occasional appearances at practices, and everything that's been at an arena has been at what are considered Laker home games. But the impact that we are seeing is that Kobe Bryant, for the first time, is not in great shape during training camp. And that's partly to do with that he had some off-season surgery and also the fact that his mind, understandably, and his time has been invested elsewhere. He's not shooting the ball well. He's the first one to say he didn't pick up a ball during the summer. So there's an impact on the court in that regard.
Los Angeles signed two future Hall of Famers, point guard Gary Payton and forward Karl Malone, during the offseason. Can these two, along with Shaquille O'Neal, keep L.A. competitive in the West, even if Bryant can't contribute the way he has in the past?
Absolutely. And the key one that you mentioned there is Shaquille O'Neal, because it still revolves around him. If he's in shape and healthy, and that's been the main problem the last couple of years, if he's ready to roll, he still is the one guy in the league that nobody else can handle. He's the one person that no other team has an answer for. And that's what makes the Lakers unique. It's not just that it was obviously great to have the tandem of two players, Bryant and O'Neal, but the fact that one of them, you know, was a guy anywhere between 330 and 360 pounds, depending on what day you were asking him to hop up on the scale, you know, that was always the X factor. So if they have Shaq playing at the level that he's proven capable of in the past, and Malone is in terrific shape, Payton is in terrific shape, and both of those guys say that they're willing to sort of step back a little bit and not demand the prominent role, it's still a very good team.
Let's talk a little bit about San Antonio. Even before the playoffs ended last year, there was a lot of speculation that Jason Kidd would join San Antonio or that maybe they'd pick up Jermaine O'Neal, but those two guys both signed with their former teams and what are the champs going to do to remain champs?
Well, they had a big roster turnover, and that's very unusual for a team to do that. There's been so much talk about the Lakers, but I think anybody that's overlooking the Spurs is making a big mistake. This is, you know, they still have Tim Duncan. That's an awfully good place to start in this so-called rebuilding expedition, which is really a renovation. They have more depth than they had last year. I think you could certainly make the case that this is a better team than it was at this time a year ago. The possibilities are still very, very promising for the Spurs.
The Nets, finalists the last 2 years, now have center Alonzo Mourning, a former All-Star, but he's played very little over the past 3 years because of a kidney disease. Does Mourning's health determine how far the Nets go?
Oh, a great deal. If he can hold up for the entire season and prove that the serious kidney ailment of years past is something that he's dealt with in a real encouraging way, this is a team that's made a step forward. Keeping Jason Kidd obviously was number one, but if you have Jason Kidd, Alonzo Mourning, Richard Jefferson, Kenyon Martin to build around, that's an awfully good team. You know, they're going to be the number one team in the East again at the start of the season, and will stay there as long as we have the center presence from Alonzo.
Just for the fun of it, I'm going to try to run a little bit of a twist on the standard request for a prediction, Scott. What is your prediction as to the next time an Eastern Conference team will be the NBA champion?
What year are we?
Yeah, and I was afraid that was going to be part of the answer.
I think we should do it. I don't know if we need to do this by years or just by generations, by somebody, by the time your grandchildren get out of med school.
Spoken like a man in Sacramento.
Well, spoken like anybody living in reality.
Miami Heat coach Pat Riley resigned yesterday. He remains the president of the Heat, so he's not going to be coaching somewhere else right away, but how about somewhere down the line?
Well, the timing of it is obviously curious. What we don't know is what this means for the long term of Pat. He had said that he wants to sort of see things through in Miami, at least as well as he can. But if you talk to a lot of coaches, and I would say most coaches, they use a lot of phrases like, it's in your blood. So while he may be saying he's staying in Miami now, it's tough to imagine that as time passes that there aren't going to be some teams that try to make a run at him. And I would think that he would have to be tempted by some of the offers.
Scott Howard Cooper is a columnist for the Sacramento Bee and is our regular NBA analyst. Scott, thank you again.
It's a pleasure.
It's not often in professional sports that a team's biggest offseason acquisition is its coach. But after the Detroit Pistons head coach Rick Carlisle helped his team win more than 50 games in each of the last two seasons, he was shown the door. The Pistons then turned to Larry Brown, late of the 76ers, and the Pacers, and the Clippers, Spurs, Nets, and Nuggets. The Pistons open their season Wednesday against the Pacers and their new coach, Rick Carlisle. As Ron Schachter reports, Detroit is hoping Brown can deliver a championship.
The Detroit Pistons have gotten younger since they lost four straight to the New Jersey Nets in last season's NBA Eastern Finals. And at the center of this youth movement stands a trim, bespectacled Larry Brown. He belies his 62 years as he demonstrates defensive moves and bounce passes to players who weren't even born when he started bouncing from team to NBA team. Chauncey Billups averaged 16 points a game in his first season in Detroit, and at age 27 has become the Pistons' new leader. He says Brown is the right man for the job.
A guy like Coach Brown is huge for us. You know, we need to be taught. We got guys who got a lot to learn. He's a great teacher. I mean, he's stopping practice. You know, when things are even going good out there, he's stopping to say, you know, we could do this better. We could do this better. And you know, when you finally do it, he rewards you out there.
Brown agrees that teaching is a big part of his game.
It's everything to me, and I don't buy this thought that pros don't want to learn and improve. I go to practice every day with our staff, trying to raise the bar for these guys and to challenge them and put them in a situation where they feel they're learning and improving.
Gone are center Cliff Robinson, forward Michael Curry, and sixth man John Barry. Detroit is leaning instead on players like Billups and highly regarded forward Tayshaun Prince, who's graduated to the starting lineup in only his second year. and the Pistons are staking their future on tall man Darko Milicic, the other celebrated 18-year-old from this summer's draft and the number 2 pick overall. But the Pistons are not starting over, which makes them an unusual choice for Brown.
You don't expect to leave one job and go to a team that's won 50 games, and based on my career, I've never gone to a winning team after I've left somewhere. I've always gone to some place that you were trying to rebuild. I've been to the Clippers or the Nets or the Spurs or the Pacers. When I went to those particular places, it was kind of a rebuilding mode.
Brown turned all of the aforementioned teams, and more recently the Philadelphia 76ers, into winners. He's collected 879 regular season victories, good for 7th place on the list of the NBA's winningest coaches. Brown's biggest project this season is the 7-foot Milicic, who hails from Montenegro in the former Yugoslavia, and who's divided his preseason between learning about NBA-style basketball, the English language, and living in the USA.
I really like living here. It's a lot easier than where I come from, you know. Where I come from, it's a lot of people that don't have money, you know. It's, you know, bad situation over there, but here, people live, a little bit easier than over there.
Although Brown sees a bright future for his new center, he doesn't expect Milicic to have the same immediate effect on the Pistons that LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony will have on their respective teams, the Cavaliers and Nuggets.
Carmelo and LeBron are not changing positions. They're comfortable with being in the United States because they're American kids. They're going to play on teams that haven't won, so they're going to have an opportunity to really flourish and show their skills. Darko's should be a senior in high school. We are changing a position for him. We're trying to make him a center where he played out on the floor a lot in Europe. It is a different experience in so many ways for him, and I think it's going to take him a little time.
Chauncey Billups adds that it's also going to take time for the new coaching staff and the old players to mesh.
We got to learn what they like, you know. They got to know what we like, and what we did the last couple years that made us so successful. What they've done all their career, Coach Brown, and made them so successful, and find a happy medium and go for it.
It's a mutual investment that the Pistons hope will yield their first championship since 1990, and Brown's first ever NBA title. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Auburn Hills, Michigan.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. The record for pulling a train with a rope one has grasped with one's teeth has fallen. Last weekend, V. Rathakrishnan pulled 6 train coaches weighing almost 261 tons, 4.2 meters. The 37-year-old Malaysian's remarkable feat was witnessed by the Prime Minister of Malaysia and his guest, the Sultan of Brunei. Mr. Rathakrishnan attributed his strength to practicing stick fighting, an ancient Indian art of self-defense, as well as to meditation. He attributes his very strong teeth to his avoidance of spicy food and cold drinks. Next, Mr. Rathakrishnan said on Sunday, I probably want to use my teeth to keep a helicopter from taking off.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Detroit Red Wings blanked the Dallas Stars 4-0. The Pittsburgh Pirates succumbed to the New Jersey Devils. The score was 2-1 in that battle of the bad guys. The Minnesota Wild edged the Florida Panthers 4-3. The St. Louis Blues doused the Calgary Flames 2-1. And the Buffalo Sabres rattled the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim 5-2. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce muses on baseball, among other things. But first, Yankee slugger Jason Giambi is in the news this week not only for his involvement, or lack of same, in the World Series. He's also been subpoenaed, along with several other well-known athletes, in the widening investigation of what could turn out to be one of the more pervasive steroid scandals ever, this one involving the anabolic steroid tetrahydrogestrinone, or THG. Joining me now on the line is Sean Assale of ESPN, the magazine. Sean, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
At the center of this investigation is the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, known as BALCO, a Burlingame, California company that provides nutritional supplements to elite athletes. How and why did this company and its owner, Victor Conti, become the focus of a federal grand jury investigation?
Well, that's a very good question. Somebody sent a syringe to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, basically the arm of the Olympics that tests for drugs. And the person who sent it was described as a high-profile track coach who said the substance in that syringe, later identified as the designer steroid THG, came from this lab, BALCO, previously known to really a very small number of elite athletes as a lab that had a specialty in testing their blood for minerals and replenishing their minerals to help them gain strength, speed, and all-around endurance.
Now, Victor Conti has denied that he's the source of the syringe that you mentioned. He claims he's just a victim of, quote, jealous competitive coaches and athletes. Is there anything to this charge?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying that he was or wasn't the source, but jealousy runs rampant in that sport. And Victor Conti was beginning to make inroads with some fairly high-profile clients. I've, in reporting this in the last week, been astounded at just how much backbiting and politics there is in that little corner of the sports world.
Jason Giambi, along with the San Francisco Giants' Barry Bonds and a few dozen other big-name athletes, all BALCO customers, will apparently testify in December. What does the grand jury hope to learn by questioning these clients?
Bill, I really think that's the question of the moment. What we're seeing here is, I believe, a little bit of metabolic McCarthyism, in as much as it's entirely possible, perhaps even probable, that this all-star list of clients went to BALCO simply seeking an edge in a perfectly legal nutritional supplement. The question is, did any of them cross the line, or were they given something that crossed the line without their knowledge? The grand jury is going to be very interested in that, but at heart, this is a tax case, and I think the grand jury wants to know most and foremost how much money they gave BALCO and whether that money made its way into a tax return.
Bonds' attorney has stated that he was told by a prosecutor that his client was, quote, a witness and not a target, which would seem consistent with what you're saying. Nevertheless, there appears to be a growing perception that Bonds, Giambi, and other BALCO clients, including track stars Marion Jones and Tim Montgomery, may have knowingly taken the so-called designer steroid, THG. What about that perception?
Well, yeah, I think it's just that. I just think it's a perception. I mean, you're absolutely right. At heart, anybody who is called to testify before a grand jury cannot be, by definition, a target of that grand jury. Otherwise, they'd receive a target letter. Neither Bonds nor Giambi has received that target letter. What did they take? When did they take it? What did they know? I don't know that yet. I don't think anybody knows that yet. This is really operating on two tracks, the legal track and the sports track. And one aim, I think, has been achieved by the people who are in the anti-doping force, and that is to put an asterisk next to the names of some people who might be considered the usual suspects. And when this all shakes out, we'll see whether that was fair or not.
According to your own recent article, as many as 40 track athletes may be subpoenaed in December, along with the ones we've mentioned. Will this help reveal what one anti-doping official has called an international doping conspiracy?
Well, what's already been revealed is that the track and field world has been, rife with this THG. Dwayne Chambers, the fastest man in London, tested positive for it. Expectations are that it's going to spread further into Europe. So perhaps there's your international part of the phrase international doping conspiracy. THG certainly is a doping drug. It's the conspiracy that I'm not yet clear on, and I don't think the people at USADA have been clear on. I think that the people at USADA have been a little fast and loose with their facts. I think that they've been looking for a marquee case to show that they're serious. And in Victor Conti, they think they found their case. Unfortunately, what they've said is not enough for any prosecutor to go into court with. As a matter of fact, based on what USADA has given us so far, a judge would never even let this case go to trial. So I think there's a little bit of fast and looseness with the facts.
Last week, the USOC gave USA Track and Field a November 17th deadline to solve what it has called the doping and athlete conduct issues, or to face decertification if they weren't solved. Is that a realistic time frame?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, look, this thing is moving so fast that I think you're going to see a lot of knee-jerk reactions. I mean, we, you know, the track and field people have now adopted a zero-tolerance policy, one strike and you're out. I think what you're seeing now is the posturing phase. I think we need to let the dust settle a little bit and see if USADA has, in fact, made their case. They may well have. But if they haven't, I think you're going to see an enormous backlash. So what you're in right now is the posturing and helium phase.
You mentioned that one strike and you're out policy. Is that a sufficient deterrent? And if not, what would be?
I'm not sure if it would be a sufficient deterrent or if it would be a draconian echo of the Rockefeller drug laws. I mean, I just don't know. It doesn't seem to me to be the answer. What may be the answer is encouraging whistleblowers. Without a whistleblower, this case would never have come to pass, which is why, to some extent, it's a little bit of a misnomer to think that we've gotten some, you know, huge breakthrough here in drug testing. What we had is a guy willing to drop a dime or perhaps drop a syringe. That's where we need to go. Otherwise, you're going to consistently see designer steroids still flying under the radar, and one strike and you're out policy is no good if you can't see whether the batter whiffed.
Sean Assale writes for ESPN, the magazine. Sean, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, I hope it helped. Thank you, Bill.
Tonight in Game 6 of the World Series, the New York Yankees will host the Florida Marlins in the Bronx. Florida currently leads the series 3-2. ESPN's Tim Kirkjian joins me now for a discussion of the series to date, as well as George Steinbrenner's blood pressure. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. Like a lot of people, I was discouraged when neither the Red Sox nor the Cubs made the World Series, but the Marlins have been great fun to watch. You have to love a team where the pitcher hits, the center fielder looks as if he's about 16 years old, everybody runs, and nobody seems to realize that the World Series is supposed to be about pressure.
You're right about the pressure. I really believe that these guys are so young and so inexperienced, they don't quite understand. They're playing the New York Yankees in the World Series, and they're not supposed to be here, and they're not supposed to beat them, but they are a wonderful story, the Florida Marlins.
Great late-season acquisitions who help teams in the postseason are frequently pitchers, and even more frequently perhaps relief pitchers, but my candidate for most valuable newcomer to a potential champion this season is the Marlins' Jeff Conine. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right, Bill. In fact, I'm writing about something to that effect this week. Jeff Conine was with the Orioles, a former Marlin, of course, one of the most popular Marlins in history. He comes to Florida, and you're thinking, he can't help that much, can he? And as it turns out, he had 5 home runs in September, the most home runs he's ever hit in September in any month of his career. All 5 of them were crucial home runs, and he's become a really important guy for the Marlins and a veteran hand with a bunch of young guys, so they can all look at him and say, hey, this guy's got a ring. If we have any questions about how this works, we'll go over and ask him, because he's the only guy who knows.
Tim, does the apparent vulnerability of the Yankees in this series make you wonder how New York managed to look as good as it did for as long as it did? And was Joe Torre doing even more than we realized with even less than we thought he had?
Well, I think you're right on all counts, and I think this has been Joe Torre's best managerial job ever. And he has said it's the hardest job he's had as a manager this year. And if you look at all the distractions, led, of course, by George Steinbrenner to Derek Jeter's injury, to David Wells' book, and everything in between, Joe Torre has done a magnificent job getting this team to 100 wins in the regular season and to the World Series, because this is the most flawed Yankee team that we've seen in the postseason, certainly during this remarkable run starting in 1996. And in many ways, I look at them and say, how did they get this far? They don't have any middle relief. They have about 7 guys in their lineup that you basically can pitch to. They're not a very good defensive team, yet here they are, 2 wins away from the World Series.
All those flaws that you mentioned notwithstanding, the Yankees are home tonight and tomorrow night if it goes to Game 7, and New York's Game 6 and Game 7 starters are rested and ready on their normal rest, unlike their Marlin counterparts. Do these advantages translate into another Yankees championship?
Well, I think they translate that the Yankee pitching certainly is set up better. The Marlins are going to take a big risk starting Josh Beckett in Game 6 because he's pitching on 3 days' rest. And we've talked about this before, Bill. The numbers are hideous for any pitcher who tries to pitch on short rest in the postseason. And even though this guy is 23 years old and a horse, I think it's a risky thing. But I love the Marlins for trying it. As always, Jack McKeon is making the gutsy play here. And if it works, he's a genius. If it doesn't, who knows? But the one thing the Yankees have in their favor, Bill, is the last six road teams, in this case the Yankees, to lose Game 5 and fall behind in the World Series have come back to win Games 6 and 7. It happened last year with the Angels. They lost in San Francisco in Game 5, and everyone said, oh, they're in big trouble. They came back and won the next two. Same thing that the Diamondbacks did to the Yankees in 2001. Now the Yankees come home for two games where it's going to be really cold and really loud, and they have two really good starting pitchers going, Pettit and Mike Mussina. So I think you can make a case that even though the Yankees are behind, they still have an advantage in this series.
Tim Kirchen of ESPN joins me to discuss baseball throughout the season, for which I am very grateful. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
Today at Santa Anita, horses with dignified names, such as Evening Attire, Perfect Drift, and Medaglia d'Oro, are scheduled to compete in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Fans from all over have long appreciated the flair with which many horses are named, and they often bet accordingly.
By nose, at the wire.
Bear It All, B-A-R-E, It All.
Awfully Wild, I love that horse's name.
Grits and Hard Toast.
A trip to Hialeah 10 years ago made reporter Karen Russo curious about the thoroughbred naming process. She recently traveled to Lexington, Kentucky to learn more about it, and she has this report.
There was a horse called Fuss, 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 and she was out of Nag, Nag, Nag. How about Your Tent or Mine out of a mare called Wigwam Duchess? My favorite name of all time. There was a stallion called Judge Smells.
Buddy Bishop is the registrar of the Jockey Club, the breed registry for all thoroughbred horses in North America. He approves or rejects the 35,000 name proposals that cross his desk each year. There are many guidelines. For example, names are limited to 18 characters and cannot end in words like stud or stallion. Most names are a combination of the names of the foal's sire and dam. Bishop's all-time favorite horse, Native Dancer, came from Polynesian and Geisha Girl.
That horse was owned by Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt, and he took great pride in naming his horses. He would throw parties, and he would have people come to his house, and he would give them the pedigree of each horse, and they would sit there and try and come up with a great name.
One rule forbids names that are obscene or even slightly suggestive. Horse owners constantly try to push limits, and names like Honor and Offer and Shiny City Shoes occasionally go through. And Bishop says he knows who they are.
Most of my problems come from two or three gentlemen out there that like to play a game. And like I said, it's fun for them, but it's not for me.
One of the gentlemen to whom Bishop is likely referring is Mike Pegram, who was honored with his own bobblehead doll this summer at Ellis Park in Henderson, Kentucky. In 1998, he teamed with trainer Bob Baffert to win the Kentucky Derby with Real Quiet. But it's Pegram's creative names, like Straight to Bed and Is It In Good, that cause a stir over at the Jockey Club.
I think I've been singled out a little bit.
Why?
I think Is It In Good, when he got so good and made all the money, there was a lot of heat that came down on that one. I named it right there because Bob Baffert was sitting between Becky Thomas and Murray Smith at the Ocala Sale. These are people that everybody in the horses knew, and Luke McCathan came up, and again, he's a character, came, look at old Bob, he's sitting good. And that's when we started playing with I sitting good, Is It In Good, and the play on words.
I've seen them spell names backwards, and
seen them use abbreviations and things to try to sneak things back past the jockey club. Yeah, there have been some dandies.
Paul Kersey is the general manager of Ellis Park Racetrack in Henderson, Kentucky.
With a lot of owners, when they name their horses, they will try to get something that is a little sexy or a little objectionable and try to get it as sneak it past the jockey club without the jockey club recognizing that it is something maybe that shouldn't be there.
Inside Maximus Decimus in striking range, he's 5.5 off the lead. Then Kentucky Squalls next by 3 more to Gangplank. Nick Bollett.
Ellis Park track announcer Luke Kreitboss has called about 40,000 races in his lifetime, involving everything from thoroughbreds to ostriches. But even for him, some names are tough to say.
There was one yesterday, which puts you in such a predicament because the horse's name is Hall, H-A-L-L, and then a space, and then Lass, L-A-S-S.
That's
so yesterday, it was, and we're going down the back stretches, and the trailer is Hall Lass. And they told me, actually, the publicity guys there told me the crowd cracked up when I said it, so.
Did Hall Lass win?
No, beat about 2 horses, yeah. But you can't stop. I mean, you can say, and on the outside, it's Hall Lass. You have to kind of let it run together, so.
Hall Lass, owner Lansden Robbins, recalls the night he named his crowd pleaser.
And I was with a friend one night, and we were thinking about horse names. And my friend, he's a little young, and he's like, hey, how about, you know, horses are supposed to run fast. How about Hall Lass, H-A-U-L-A-S-S? I'm like, my mind started spinning a little bit. I'm like, beer hall, so beer hall, and then a lass is a girl. So Hall, H-A-L-L, and then lass. A girl, L-A-S-S, put it together, maybe they won't catch it. So you can register online. I did that night. The next day they approved it, and I was shocked.
One of Robin's trainers at Saratoga is Jimmy Jerkins, son of Hall of Fame horse trainer Alan Jerkins. He has his own ideas about horse names.
When they turn out to be good, it makes the name sound better.
Yeah.
Like my father years ago had a... I was called Onion. I mean, could you get a worse name than that? He ends up beating Secretariat up here in New Whitney, and then all of a sudden Onion didn't sound so bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Bishop says he doesn't normally allow names of notorious people, but that doesn't stop some owners from trying.
Somebody tried Adolf Hitler.
Why would they do that to a horse?
That's a good question. Maybe they didn't like the horse. I don't know.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Russo in Lexington, Kentucky.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA preseason action, Utah topped Orlando by a score of 93-84. Boston bested New Jersey 86-82. Detroit manhandled Milwaukee 96-86. Denver downed Indiana 109-92. And Sacramento defeated the Lakers 93-87. Elsewhere, Atlanta vanquished Washington 89-85, Houston beat San Antonio 84-63, Portland prevailed over Phoenix 95-92, and the LA Clippers beat Golden State 97-89 in overtime. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new book about the overemphasis of sports at some places that may surprise you. But first, our discussion of the week's news with analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Exactly a week ago, the pundits predicted World Series ratings would be lower than a Brad Penny splitter, but the latest numbers indicate that many, many have tuned in to the Fall Classic. Are you surprised?
I am, actually, although I think there's a lot of momentum from the league playoffs, which had high-profile teams. They had the Cubs and, of course, the Red Sox and the Yankees. And I think there's a little bit of spillover. I think there's the natural constituency that wants to see the Yankees lose, which they are quite capable of doing at this point. And the presence of the Yankees always means something. So, yes, it's the best postseason numbers that baseball's had since 1995.
Okay, now you say the Yankees are quite capable of losing. Is that the outcome you anticipate?
I still don't, believe it or not. I think they're going to go home and win two games. I think one of the things we are looking at is another classic Game 6 in the long line of them.
Charlie, there has been much reshuffling of basketball players since last we spoke. Did the Celtics get better? Did the Mavericks get better?
I think the Mavericks have gotten better. I think Antoine Walker will help that bunch a great deal. The Celtics, I have absolutely no idea. So much depends on Welsh, because he seems to be the one that Danny Ainge was really trying to get. Rafe LaFrenz is a pretty ordinary center who will have one good game and two mediocre ones. In return, Dallas got a 27-year-old All-Star, a guy who's much more versatile and who quite plainly had worn out his welcome with the new regime in Boston. So I've got to give the advantage in this trade to Dallas so far.
The Alabama Department of Public Safety is setting a precedent that could take the taxpayer down there off the hook, at least when it comes to sporting events. What's this all about?
Apparently the Alabama college football teams are escorted by state troopers. There's 17 of them, apparently, escort 10 different football teams. They stay at the hotel. They hang around the lobby. They make sure gamblers don't get near the players. It is what we would call a quasi-necessary luxury, and that it probably is a good idea given the fervor of some of these rivalries that there is somebody there. But there's an 18% cut in state funding, including, only having like 6 or 8 troopers at night patrolling the highways. So I think if you are prioritizing in an era of limited resources, having a few more guys on the highway chasing drunk drivers and speeders on Saturday night and a few less hanging around the lobby of the hotel saying "Roll Tide" under their breath seems like a good place to start.
In my favorite National Football League story of the week, the owner of the 1-6 Atlanta Falcons has written a letter of apology to Atlanta football fans. I wonder if that has made season ticket holders feel better about the considerable investment that they've made.
Well, it apparently has. It's apparently gone over very well in Atlanta, although any intelligent football fan knows that the reason Atlanta's really bad is that quarterback Michael Vick has been out all year. Two starting linebackers are out for the rest of the year, and Keith Brookings can miss up to a month and a half with a back injury, costing the team another linebacker. I'm sure that there were several high-level meetings of phony baloney marketing executives who said this was a good idea. I do like the fact that he refers to the Atlanta Falcons under his tenure as the new Atlanta Falcons, all caps, which certainly has more than a few fingerprints of the marketing people on it.
In my second favorite football story of the week, a youth team coach in Pennsylvania gave his 10 and 11-year-old players a sugar pill before the game and told them that it would improve their performance. This guy wasn't wearing a Balco sweatshirt, was he?
No, it's an interesting story because it sort of indicates that we are of such two or three minds about pills. First of all, the coaches announced that they weren't really pills, they were tablets. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means.
That's a classic distinction that these people make when they get caught.
And it points out that the pills themselves had less sugar than Gatorade or an orange slice, and that he gave them out because some of the players had been throwing up after eating the orange slices or candy. Now, that may be more information than we need to know in the story. It appears to me that what has gotten everybody in an uproar in Washington County, Pennsylvania, is that they were pills. If there truly was less sugar than an orange slice, then it's not as harmful. But the fact is that you're acclimating children to look for something in a pill.
Well, and not only acclimating children, but saying to very young athletes, here's how to improve your performance.
Take this and you'll get better.
Right.
Although if you said that about an orange slice, people wouldn't care.
That's likely true. Also in the wonderful world of football, Dolphins linebacker Junior Seau said the way for the Dolphins to stop Chargers running back LaDainian Tomlinson would be to feed him fried chicken and watermelon. What do you suppose he meant by that?
Well, apparently, Seau and Tomlinson were very close. Tomlinson came to San Diego. Seau showed him the ropes. And apparently they actually did eat a lot of fried chicken together as friends. You know, bells go off, obviously. It became a story, which is, I think, all to the good. I think that if we're all a little bit more sensitive about stuff like that, that's all to the good. It doesn't look like there's going to be any discipline involved. Tomlinson wore Junior Seau's jersey to practice as a gesture of solidarity. And I'm sure that, you know, Seau has learned a lesson in what you say and what you don't say in public.
British explorer Renouf Fiennes is planning to run 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. I would hate to be this guy's travel agent.
5 months after suffering a near-fatal heart attack.
Ah, yes.
Now, let's explore the concept of what we here in the colonies call pushing your luck, okay? 5 months after suffering a near-fatal heart attack, he's going to run these 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. He's going to start, by the way, in Antarctica, getting the most obscure continent out of the way first. Already, by the way, in his 59 years on this planet, he got gangrene at the North Pole. They shot at him at the Middle East. He walked across the Andes and canoed up the Amazon. I certainly hope the Penguins come out and give him a hand.
Finally, Charlie, the Scottish rugby team.
Oh, not again.
Yes, they're back.
Oh, the poor lads.
The lads that were run out of their hotel by a bunch of bikers have now been told that they cannot bring their bagpipers onto the field for the ongoing World Cup in Australia. What next? No clothes? No food? No haggis?
Actually, there is something next. They can't bring the knife out either. There's a ceremonial dagger that they wear in their socks, and they can't wear them during the game with Japan. Now, I'm not exactly sure why anybody would be worried about very large men playing a very violent game in a week where nothing pretty much has gone right for the poor lads, having knives in their socks. But, you know, you go figure, the security people in Australia probably know what they're doing.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and drones on and each week. Oh, my goodness, a bagpipe joke.
Ooh.
At this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Reclaiming the Game, subtitled College Sports and Educational Values, is not an easy read. It's not a comfortable read either. In this book, several collaborators present in rather academic fashion the case that the wildly disproportionate emphasis on sports is present not just at the Division I football and basketball factories, but on the campuses of some of this country's most prestigious colleges and universities. James L. Shulman, who was one of the collaborators in Reclaiming the Game, joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Shulman, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
People picking up this book may be surprised that in analyzing the influence of sports on campus, you and the other contributors have not written about places like Ohio State, Miami, Notre Dame, and Michigan. Are the Division I powerhouses just too far gone to be reclaimed?
Well, I think it's certainly a longer road to hoe. I think the problems there are well known, and there's things that shock people who didn't think they could be shocked anymore. But these places, I think people are a little more surprised to hear about the extent of the activity that makes a simple Colby Bates lacrosse game possible.
You found that at schools like Colby and Bates, schools like Williams and Amherst, as well as universities like Harvard and Yale, recruited high school athletes have a considerable advantage when it comes to admission. How considerable is the advantage, and how does it work?
Well, it works in an interesting way in that the coaches have an enormous amount of impact on the admissions process. They bring a list of kids that they've pre-sorted. They look for smart kids. These are all smart kids, but also kids who have a lot of talent. And not just talent, but, of course, specialized talent. Not a swimmer, but somebody who does a 100-meter butterfly. Mm. Not a lacrosse player, but somebody who plays left midfielder who really can play defense well. So that level of specialization is what's competing with the kids with the 1,500 board scores and the people who started soup kitchens. And when you're thinking about squeezing into Swarthmore College with 300 slots in the class, there are not a lot of places to hide the people who are going to fill out 30 rosters.
In the Ivy League, this book maintains at one point, quote, recruits were four times more likely to be admitted than similarly situated applicants who were not on a coach's list. This is going to really surprise a lot of people, I think.
It's pretty startling stuff, and really just because of what I was saying before about how tough it is to get into these places. We all know this. We have kids who are going through it or friends who are going through it. And the problem is the University of Michigan has 5,000 places in its entering class, 5,000 places. And so the number of athletes who make up the teams, which are very efficiently constructed because you have athletic scholarships to keep them on those teams, are really 2% of the population. So when you look at a Yale or a Brown or a Pomona or a Carleton College, these places have 300 places in the class or maybe 1,000 places in the class. So the competition is, as we know, I mean, sports aside, incredibly intense. So this becomes a real hook to get in.
Division III schools, like Ivy League schools, do not give athletic scholarships, but you found athletic directors at the D3 schools who acknowledged that, quote, merit aid awards are beginning to feel like athletic scholarships, so I gather a lot rests on the definition of merit.
It certainly does, and it's a really fuzzy area that I think has been pretty far beneath the radar. But if you think about it, one of the things that they give merit scholarships based on is leadership. Well, what is leadership, right? I mean, in the old days, if you were the captain of a sports club, like back in the teens when most of the college sports programs weren't organized varsity teams, they were clubs. Well, as a captain of a team then, you set up the schedule, you found funding, you got uniforms. It may have been a real leadership thing. You know, now you're the captain of your lacrosse team in high school. It means you probably, you know, call heads or tails for the coin flip. But that may well count as leadership in this sort of game to figure out how to attract the best players.
At Williams College, you identify a, quote, the dumbing down effect. How does that work?
Well, I think one of the things you realize is that one thing that we should realize is that most of these colleges are completely arts and sciences. They don't have business programs, and they pride themselves on not doing that. A lot of what one finds in the kids who are playing sports are really inclination towards the professions, which is great. We need business leaders who come from these places. But they're not as focused on academics. Their performance isn't as good. Their credentials coming in, they aren't as well prepared. And then there's a performance gap against what would have been predicted of them. And so if they tend to cluster in, say, economics, because it's the closest thing they can find to a business major, that's bound to affect how the teaching and the classroom atmosphere of economics takes place at a small place like Williams.
Reclaiming the Game discusses at length the, quote, athletic divide. Why is that something that conscientious college administrators should be wary of?
What we mean by the divide is just that there are differences at the time of admission in terms of academic preparation. There are differences in how people do in school, athletes and non-athletes, men and women. There are differences in, as I said earlier, how they do, even against how they themselves would be predicted to do based on the statistics. And so there really is getting to be two cultures. And a large part of this is just how selective these schools are and how incredibly well-prepared and well-rounded and talented, you know, the student bodies are. The reason the divide is of concern is that, I mean, frankly, and I think this feeds into the title of the book, there's no real need for it to be there. In the sense that there are kids who are at these schools and or are there through sort of regular admissions who would love to play soccer, who would love to put on the purple uniforms or whatever and go out there and do battle and sweat and cry and learn all those lessons about life. So it's just when you are really focused on raising the collective talent level that you end up with this divide.
The athletic divide, as you describe it, is caused by several developments. One of them is athletes becoming more specialized at a younger age. How does a college or university have an impact on that trend when it involves, I don't know, 9- and 10-year-olds?
This is a great topic because people always say to me, oh, you know, the problem is not college sports, certainly not at these places. The problem is we're a sports-crazy culture. Fine. We are certainly a sports-crazy culture, but we are also a culture where the most important academic institutions are sending incredibly clear signals to those 9- and 10-year-olds and to their parents that this is the best way to get in. And so, you know, I meet plenty of people who say, oh, you know, college sports are fine and what happens at Princeton is fine. But, you know, gosh, we have traveling teams for our soccer, our daughter in second grade. Isn't that insane? Well, it's not insane if it's the best way to get in, isn't it?
The recommendations for reform at the end of Reclaiming the Game include de-emphasis of athletics, both in terms of admissions criteria and in terms of goals. You suggest that schools shouldn't worry so much about winning championships, for example. But how do you convince administrators and coaches committed to their version of athletic excellence of the necessity for reform?
Well, it's an interesting question. We talk to a lot of presidents. We talk to a lot of trustees. There's a growing awareness that this tension is real and is significant. But I think in the end, it may be one of these cases where things might have to get worse before they get better. And what I mean by getting worse is that there are a lot of people out there who whose son, whose daughter, whose nephew is applying somewhere, you know, has 1550 board scores, plays field hockey, but just plays it okay, may have, you know, maybe a superstar in the chemistry lab, and doesn't get into where he or she, you know, where she wants to go. And all of a sudden, I think they're sort of scratching their heads and they say, why are we so focused on, you know, winning the softball championship or the track championship and the Division III national championship where you have to fly to Ohio to compete in it, and my daughter's not getting in? So I think until there's a growing sense that these data are real, the trends are real, and that we might just need to rethink our priorities and the level of balance, you know, things may drift along and not change.
James L. Shulman is one of the contributors to Reclaiming the Game, College Sports and Educational Values, published by Princeton University Press. Mr. Shulman, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or learn more about Reclaiming the Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word pertains to the importance of a horse's name and comes from exercise rider Robert Smith.
Colbert will never win the Derby.
No, I agree. I think you want to name your Derby winner Mint Julep or Sour Mash or maybe Me First. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.